Dr. Nancy Krieger is Associate Professor in the Department of Health and Social Behavior at the Harvard School of Public Health, and she's the Associate Director of the Harvard Center for Society and Health. She received her PhD in epidemiology from University of California, Berkeley in 1989, and in 11 or 12 short years has made a phenomenal impact in social epidemiology. She also has a background in biochemistry, philosophy of science, and many of us also know her work in the history of public health. She is a longtime researcher in inequalities, and some of the areas in which she's focused are the measures of social class. Particularly, she has studied their impact on the health of women and the use of measures of social class in our major databases like the census. She has looked at the roles of exogenous carcinogens in breast cancer and associations between elevated breast blood pressure and discrimination based on race and ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation. She's also an activist socially and professionally. She is one of the founders of the Spirit of 1848, a caucus in the American Public Health Association that has been instrumental in raising and sort of keeping public health honest in terms of its core values of social justice and public health. I'm going to ask Dr. Krieger to come forward. I'm also going to charge the respondents to be thinking about what she says in terms of what does it mean for our practice, what does it mean for providers, what does it mean for our programs and policy, and to be thinking very concrete about how to take what she has to share with us today and translate it into those realms. Dr. Krieger.
Thank you. It's great to be here today and to speak to an audience who's committed to make rhetoric turn to reality. And I think that's the task that we face in terms of any ambitious charge to eliminate racial and ethnic disparities in health in this country and also other forms of social inequalities in health. So we can have a lot of fine words about it, but we also need to understand what the obstacles are, what we're up against, and we also need to develop from the standpoint to the extent that science does contribute to this process of eliminating social inequalities in health to improving the content of our science. And that's in a sense the theme that I was asked to speak about today in some ways by Dr. Stephen Thomas. And again, I'm very grateful to be able to be here to be part of this effort. So next slide, please. The topics that I'll be speaking about today are essentially about analyzing the effects of racial discrimination in health. And I'll be giving some sense of what might be some useful frameworks, concepts, and context for epidemiologic research and embodying racial inequality, which is one form of many of social inequalities that we nonetheless embody. I'll be giving two examples from my own research because I think they raise interesting questions, including what the limitations of the research are, as well as what some of the possible strengths might be. The research on race, class, gender, and cancer, and also racial discrimination and blood pressure. I say, using this word advisedly, that second study, which I'll be presenting, which is older data from the Cardia study in 1996, is right now, for example, the literal quote-unquote whipping boy of the conservatives that are opposed to the kind of research that we're doing and the kinds of efforts that we're having right now. And then I'll talk a little bit at the end about implications for research on and remedies for racial, ethnic, and other social inequalities in health. Next slide. The rationale for doing research on racial discrimination is not to prove that it's bad. Definition. That's obvious. It's a tautology. Rather, the purpose instead is to identify who and what shapes societal health so as to generate empirical evidence useful for spurring effective interventions to promote social equity in health, and also to explicitly identify allies who help and also the obstacles who hinder efforts to put our findings into action. If we don't name this topic out loud, we don't get very far. Why then also this theme, next slide please, of cross-cutting issues? Well, there's a question that's worth considering, which is when you pause to think about it, can you name a health outcome that's not affected by racial discrimination? It's really hard. I promise you, I had to go through this exercise for a grant that I was writing to figure out what would be a health outcome that I could come up with that wouldn't be associated with a measure that would help show the right kind of discriminant validity. So what's at issue are the myriad effects of discrimination on health, and it's important to recognize both common pathways that cut across numerous specific diseases, and that underscores the significance of focusing on these cross-cutting issues that Stephen has asked us to draw attention to today. Next slide. The conceptual framework that I draw on is one that I'll term ecosocial theory. It's related to, but I think a little distinct from the model that was presented earlier this morning, and I think provides a useful grounds of contrast. What this theory wants to ask is how population distributions of health, disease, and well-being are conjointly shaped by our social, biologic, and ecologic history. Biology is not simply something that is in the domain of the biomedical model. Biology is something that we have because we're organisms. And understanding our biology and not letting it only be turned into the framework of a biomedical model is, I think, a rather important task. So what we want to do is combine critical analyses of society with critical analyses of biology. And that means that we draw on social and related social frameworks that emphasize social accountability and equality, but don't always necessarily address biology that clearly. These could include frameworks such as those that Dr. Freudenberg alluded to, social production of disease or political economy of health, health and human rights analyses, which we haven't heard a lot yet about today, feminist, anti-racist, LGBT or queer analyses of health, etc. And that what these clearly contrast to are frameworks that are more what we've been steeped in most of our traditional training, which are fundamentally individualistic and typically focus on biomedical and lifestyle explanations of quote-unquote causes of disease, not causes of disease distribution in populations. Next slide, please. So some key concepts that might prove helpful to your thinking and your work that come from ecosocial theory. The first is embodiment, often a word bandied about in anthropologic literature, this time now taken literally. How do we, as social beings and biological organisms, literally incorporate biologically our social experiences across the life course and express this embodiment in population patterns of health, disease, and well-being? What are the pathways of embodiment? How are they structured by societal arrangements of power and constraints and possibilities of our biology? What is the cumulative interplay of exposure, susceptibility, and resistance at multiple levels in multiple domains? And above all, what about accountability and agency? What about the pathways of and knowledge about embodiment to understand both the biologic expression of social inequality and also how social inequality distorts our understanding of biology and causes of distributions of disease in populations? Next slide. I'll give you some definitions of terms to make this abstract thinking more concrete. So we can talk about biologic expression of social experience. And we can talk about expression of inequality through biologic processes. For example, we can talk about biologic expressions of class relations. Childhood poverty leads to shorter height, and that's associated with an increased susceptibility to infectious disease. We can talk about, as I will extensively in the rest of this talk, biologic expressions of race relations. Racial discrimination causes a particular kind of chronic stress leading to increased allostatic load, therefore increased risk of hypertension and diabetes. It's not to suggest that the biology is over here and society is over here. Rather, it's how these come together in understandings and allows us to take on the biology of the modern technology in ways that are conversant with the same time principles of social justice. And we can talk about biologic expressions of gender relations, for example, how domestic violence can reduce options to negotiate safe sex and therefore increase risk of HIV infection or other STDs. So that we end up with what can be considered a biology of inequality, which is manifested simultaneously at every level, from gene expression to population patterns of health, disease, and well-being. This moves us away from frameworks that stress proximal versus distal causes, because it says within that cell, you're watching all of it at play. Within that population, you're watching all of it at play. And I think it calls for a different kind of integrated thinking that I think we're capable of. And so what we're talking about then is the embodiment of social experience, that we cannot separate our biologic existence from our social conditions. And for example, one very crude one, autopsies done traditionally on the poor set a standard for what the right size of the adrenal gland was, leading to treatment of adrenal gland disorders among richer people, which actually wasn't a disorder whatsoever, and caused a lot of iatrogenic illness. Where do our norms come from, after all? So that leads us to the next thing, next slide, about definitions of terms, about social distortions of biology. And a point that I think is worth emphasizing today is that we have a lot of racialized expressions of biology. That's what we've been taught to think about. We've been taught to take arbitrary physical characteristics, whether it's skin color, hair type, facial features, or certain diseases, sickle cell anemia, cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs syndrome, and to interpret them tautologically, that means a definition that builds exactly on what it was defined to be, and erroneously as evidence of fundamental innate biological differences between racial groups. This is a problem because, in fact, there's way more heterogeneity among groups than there is between them, and that we are not paying attention when we take these selected examples of single Mendelian traits to understand the very complex diseases that we have that distribute according to lines of power in our society. But what we end up with this approach is a way in which biology is crassly invoked to justify social inequality, that we have allegedly innate biology rather than social inequality posited as the cause of social inequalities in health, so that race rather than racism becomes the cause of racial ethnic inequalities in health. Next slide. If you're going to adopt this kind of thinking, you have to start talking about social relationships of inequality. And I'll just give some constructs here that are in relation to race, ethnicity, class, and gender. Obviously, you could bring in sexuality, age, and a whole host of others, but I'll stick somewhat to the topic at hand. So we have to talk about our groups, social groups forged by social relationships involving property, power, and inequality, with dominant groups benefiting from subordinating others. This kind of framework makes it different than just simply describing problems among poor people, but actually asking how come those problems persist and endure. In terms of class, we have, as was alluded to by some of the earlier speakers today, we have economically dominant versus subordinate groups, for example, owners, employers, supervisors, compared to, say, non-supervisory employees. For race, ethnicity, we have racially dominant versus oppressed groups, for example, white Americans versus African Americans. Gender, we have culture-bound roles defining oppressive as well as also affirming relations of men versus women and boys versus girls. And these are distinct realities, but they become connected in our bodies. It's not that one day you're white, one day you're a woman, one day you come from this class background. They happen simultaneously, and we have to be able to start to think about that as well. The one term that I want to spend a little time defining relevant to today, next slide please, is that of race ethnicity. And the definition that I'll be working from is that it's a social category referring to social groups often sharing cultural heritage and ancestry forged by oppressive systems of race relations that are justified by ideology, in which one group benefits from others through dominating other groups and defines itself and others through the domination and possession of selective arbitrary physical characteristics, for example, skin color. It's not a valid biologic category. It's a real social category with profound biological consequences. That's a different way of thinking about the determinants of racial ethnic disparities in health. So what does that then mean? Next slide, please. We can start to talk about different pathways of embodying racism. And it's not that one is more important than the other, that they actually are occurring simultaneously, but they may have different meanings for different outcomes that we're studying. Specificity matters, not just one overarching generalized claim of a fundamental cause of ill health. I think that's spurious, and it discounts the importance of very specific targeted public health interventions, as well as overall improvement of living standards. So we can talk, if we're going to talk about some of the pathways, we can have economic and social deprivation, whether experienced at work, at home, in the neighborhood, or other such sites. We can talk about differential exposures to toxic substances and hazardous conditions. We can talk about socially inflicted trauma, whether it be mental, physical, or sexual, ranging from verbal to violent. We can talk about targeted marketing of legal and illegal psychoactive substances and also other things like junk foods. We can talk about inadequate health care and other forms of social services and medical services. We can also talk about resistance to racial oppression in terms of individual and community resources and social movements to counter racism and enhance dignity. All these things come together in terms of figuring out what are the pathways to embodying racism and also resisting it. Now, what's some of the evidence that drives a surge to even lead people to want to ask these questions? Next slide, please. You have some of this summarized in the handouts that I know you all received in your conference packet today. But clearly, there's this extensive population data on racial ethnic disparities in health, disparities in socioeconomic position, and on the everyday realities of racial discrimination, whether institutional or interpersonal. And there's also relevant data from a biologic standpoint that's crucial to understanding the discourse today on life course embodiment of harmful exposures and also on neuroendocrine and physiologic responses to chronic threats, which can be construed as a biologic expression of race relations. Next slide, please. So I know you're familiar with the data, but it's always helpful to remember that if you look at very different kinds of outcomes, whether it's prenatal care, whether it's infant deaths, whether it's percent for people reporting fair poor health, whether it's percent hypertensive, whether it's people with AIDS, that you see typically a pattern of those who have the least resources in society doing the worst. And particularly that's concentrated in this country among blacks and African Americans. It again varies by specific outcomes, which groups are most differentially harmed. If we go to the next slide, we see that these are not momentary occurrences. In fact, you can look at compare black-white ratios for the 10 leading causes of death for 1995 and 1980 and see virtually the same pattern with black excess compared to white from almost all these different causes. Unless you're going to posit that there's something uniquely different about each and every genetic pathway that's involved, you begin to start to wonder what are the different conditions in which people live that would lead to these manifold higher rates for many different kinds of outcomes involving many different organ systems. Next. So one place that you'll go to is start to think about perhaps racial ethnic inequalities in income. And the data are well known, the threefold higher rate of poverty among the Hispanic and black population as defined by the census compared to the white population. What's not as well known is that the gap in income is far smaller than the gap in wealth. So that, in fact, if you compare what the median income is, you have a 60% lower median income, say, of the black compared to white population. But if you compare wealth, actually looking at assets, you have a much bigger difference. It's only 10%. And worse, what you find is that among people who are poor, typically categorized only as poor, the gap in what is wealth in terms of what the resources are, if people need any kind of, if anything bad happens, what cushion do you have to fall on, is virtually not there for African Americans. It's $1 as the median net worth in the lowest income quintile in 1991 compared to $10,000 for equally poor whites who are characterized just by the income level. So these are some pretty profound differences in economic resources. But it's not only that. Next slide, please. What we also have and what we can document are the negative racial attitudes that have been shown most recently in U.S. national polls, even when people know that they're not supposed to say things that indicate they're quote-unquote prejudiced. So that you have one poll saying that 51% of whites in 1994 saying that equal rights for minorities have been pushed too far. You have another national poll that came out saying that the majority of whites, quote, believe black Hispanic people are more likely than whites to be lazy, violence-prone, less intelligent, and less patriotic. And you have the three-quarters of the whites believing that, quote, black and Hispanic people are more than likely than whites to prefer living on welfare. These are ugly social facts. The question is, what's the meaning of these ugly social facts, not only for our body politic, but also as manifested in our very bodies? Next slide, please. So what we want to do is take data and go from these data to research questions asking about racial discrimination in health. And we can ask questions about utilization of health services. We can ask, given comparable symptoms, are there differences in referral rates, and what causes that? Is it just simply patient ignorance? Is something else going on? Those kinds of studies, we typically have to ask data, look at the results indirectly, because people rarely know they're being discriminated against by their healthcare provider. They don't have a frame of reference. You wouldn't expect to. Similarly, you're not going to know if you're being discriminated against in work and your pay unless you know what somebody else's pay scale is. You can only make those kinds of inferences based on indirect observation of what the patterns are of their provision of care. You can also do more detailed studies that look at patient-physician interaction, for example, but that answers a different question. You can ask other kinds of questions about what the role of socioeconomic inequalities are. Do the racial ethnic differences persist when you take into account reasonably good measures of socioeconomic position? But you also find that you need to start asking questions about people's experiences of racial discrimination, and that is something which has been hardly done. To date, there are about 25 studies in the literature, the public health literature, that have begun to ask questions explicitly about people's experiences of racial discrimination and related to somatic health outcomes. There's a little bit more in the mental health literature, but not a whole lot. And it's a little sobering to realize that to date, in 1966, there have been about 34,000 articles indexed by race in Medline, one of the main sources of information that biomedical and health researchers get their journal citations from. And of them, that 25 articles is only 0.07%. It suggests that we have a little ways to go in developing a body of research here. So what I'd like to do now is turn to two examples that begin to show what recasting data can look like in terms of spurring new questions for intervention. The first, next slide please, is a study that I did with colleagues at the Kaiser and also with several community-based organizations in California on race, ethnicity, social class, and the incidence of cancer. Next slide please. To date, there are only literally 8 published studies in the U.S. that have looked at cancer incidence simultaneously in relationship to race, ethnicity, and social class, and all but one included only black and white Americans. The findings were that the socioeconomic gradients in cancer incidence were evident in most racial ethnic groups, and that the socioeconomic position contributed some but not all to explain the racial ethnic disparities in cancer incidence. One of the big obstacles is that there's no economic data collected in cancer registries. That's because cancer registries typically get their information about people from people's medical charts. Physicians don't typically ask about people's income or any other measures of education or any as basic as that in the medical charts. Therefore, the information is not there. How do you start to get around that? This is an area of major concern of mine in terms of how do we begin to build monitoring systems in this country that can start to document class inequalities in health within as well as across racial ethnic groups. Next slide, please. The methodology for this particular study was looking at the population in 7 counties in the San Francisco Bay Area from 1998 to 1992, looking at the 5 leading sites of cancer, breast, cervix, colon, lung, and prostate. And the strategy was using census block group data to characterize people in terms of the socioeconomic conditions of their residential neighborhood. A block group, as you know, is a unit that's defined by the census that has an average of about 1,000 people. And you can say this is a predominantly poor block group, this is a predominantly affluent block group. You can say, do people who live in poor block groups have this rate of cancer? Do people who live in rich block groups have that rate of cancer? So the steps were first geocoding the cancer registry data, which is because you have people's addresses. You almost always will have addresses in medical records because people get billed to the addresses. And so you can go from those addresses to where do people actually live, and we actually are able to geocode 92% of the cases. We then created census block group socioeconomic measures, particularly in relation to working class composition and poverty level, link the data sets, and calculate the rates. Next slide, please. First, just showing you the socioeconomic distributions of the groups, what you can see quite clearly is that the African-American population, black, non-Hispanic, was concentrated in the working-class poor neighborhoods, whereas the white non-Hispanic population was concentrated in the neighborhoods that had a predominance of people who were in executive, professional, or supervisory jobs. Next slide, please. What I want to do now is give you a verbal summary first of what the lung cancer findings were, because they really show that we have to start thinking more complexly. We can't just make a generalization about lung cancer among African Americans or among working class people or among women or among men. Thinking about the combinations of categories is actually rather critical. So first, if you just did crude racial ethnic comparisons, obviously all age adjusted, the incidence was highest among the black Americans, both women and men. If you start to bring class into the picture, what you find is that the incidence is also very high among white women and men living in the working class poor neighborhoods. If you think about what the class gradient is within these different groups, you find that the incidence is highest among persons in working class block groups for everyone but the Hispanic population, for whom the incidence was highest in the professional block groups. That's a very important finding, and it relates to differences in terms of immigration and different smoking patterns in Latin America compared to here. You're not going to get that if you don't disaggregate groups. And that also, interestingly, if you do black-white comparisons by both class and gender, what's really interesting is that there are no black-white differences within class strata for women. And for men, there were no black-white differences among those at the greatest risk, among the working class, poor block groups. But otherwise, within the more affluent strata, the risk was higher among black as compared to white men. These are, again, interesting questions if we're going to talk about really understanding where does population burden of illness fall. So now we'll look at the actual numbers. Next slide, please. What this slide will show you is, if you just look at the black-white differences for women and for men, the higher rates, incidence rates for 100,000 people of lung cancer in the black non-Hispanic population. The next slide, a little bit more complicated, is when you start to bring in gender, race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic position. And what you can see highlighted in the orange is, again, the high rates among the black population for the men, and also the white non-Hispanic populations for the men in the working class poor areas. And you can see the same pattern happening among the African-American women. So this is a reason that if you were to talk only about lung cancer among black women, you'd miss the point. There's a class gradient in that population as well, or there's a class gradient in that population among the men, and that these are important distinctions to keep in mind as well. Next slide, please. So that what happens here, that in this slide, what you can see is the last point that I was making, which is that within class strata, you see very little black-white differences among the women, but you still see a pronounced black-white difference, particularly among men that are in the more affluent groups. And that's, again, interesting in terms of thinking about life course history, who's ended up where, when, what the exposures have been. And we can get more into data interpretation and question and answer. Here, I just want you to see what the differences are when you start to begin to disaggregate data that will get us a handle on where the actual health disparities lie. We'll turn to the next study, very different outcome, blood pressure. Next slide. And this is the racial discrimination in blood pressure, the CARDIA studies. Next slide, please. In terms of research in racial discrimination in blood pressure, so far in the published literature, there are only 5 epidemiologic studies that have explicitly examined associations between self-reported experience of racial discrimination in blood pressure or hypertension. They've all been among African Americans. I list the studies here. And the findings have been typically positive, but in actually rather complex ways. And there also are experimental studies that show similar results. For example, you have people come to a lab, you show them really upsetting, angry videos. Those that have racial content lead to much higher elevations in blood pressure than those that are simply angry but not characterized by racial animus. Next slide, please. In terms of the CARDIA study, CARDIA was a cohort that was established by NIH, NHLBI, back in 1985-86. At that point, it included slightly over 5,000 young black and white women and men 18 to 27 years old at baseline in 4 U.S. cities. The idea behind CARDIA, which is really important, is that it's one thing when you start studying people and they've already got heart disease. How do you start to study people to figure out what leads up to them getting heart disease so as to provide that many more opportunities for figuring out what you can do to change life course experiences so as to prevent the things that happen at older age? And in that year 7 exam of that study, I was able to include some questions that I had developed on experiences of racial discrimination, simply asking about whether people had ever experienced racial discrimination, been hassled and made to feel inferior, or otherwise harmed around race ethnicity in any of the following situations. Very simple, ever yes, no questions in different situations. And the situations were chosen specifically with an eye to asking where does this occur, because they become, again, sites for intervention, particularly from a civil rights or human rights standpoint. So at school, getting a job, at work, getting housing, getting medical care, from the police or in the courts, on the street or in a public setting. Next slide gives the prevalence of the self-reported answers, yes. And what you can see, first of all, is that about 80% of the sample, whether women or men, reported experiencing discrimination in one or more of these situations. About half the sample said yes in 3 or more of the situations, and very interestingly, about a fifth of the sample, 20-odd%, said no to all the situations. If you look at the particular situations among African-American men, the highest-ranking ones were the street public setting, police in the courts, followed by work. Among the women, it was primarily work and getting a job. Let's take a quick look, next slide, at the socioeconomic characteristics so you can see who the CARDIA population is. It's predominantly working class. It had a range of income distribution, some quite poor, some actually doing okay by the standards of the 1980s when those data were gathered. And about 3/4 of the sample had a high school education but not 4 years of college. Next slide, please. The This next slide is a little complex, but what I want to show is what the difference is in millimeters of mercury of systolic blood pressure. And what is important to note, the numbers might look little, a difference of 3 or 4 millimeters, but when you think about an average curve, moving a curve over so the average is 3 or 4 millimeters higher shifts over the tail of the curve and starts pushing up the proportion of people who are in a higher elevation of blood pressure range. So I just want to keep that little focus in mind there. And I also want to make the point before interpreting the data that what this shows, it speaks to some of the points that were raised earlier today when you talk about heterogeneity among the African-American population, let alone any other, that here we're going to look at heterogeneity, differences in experience based on what people self-report about their experiences of racial discrimination. What you see is that class and gender both matter. That among the working class population, among the men and the women, those reporting no discrimination compared to what I thought made the logical referent group, which is those reporting moderate discrimination or one or two of the situations, had a slightly higher blood pressure. And among the men, those reporting more discrimination also had higher blood pressure by about 3 millimeters. Among those who are more professional situations, you saw the higher blood pressure being reported compared to this referent group of those reporting moderate discrimination, somewhat among the women who are reporting more discrimination, 3 or more instances, and you saw definitely lower blood pressure among the men reporting no discrimination. I'll come to the interpretation in a moment. I want to these are all, by the way, adjusted for age, education, marital partner status, body mass index, waist-to-hip ratio, alcohol consumption, and also the study center. The next slide shows what happens when you compare these different groups of African Americans stratified by self-reported experiences of discrimination to the white population, so that rather than just simply comparing black versus white, you actually compare African Americans stratified by self-reported experiences of discrimination to the white population, which, by the way, reported very little racial discrimination, as one might expect. And the important thing to note here is that the numbers that are highlighted in yellow, the ones for the working class population, those in one or two situations who had reported discrimination, and among the executive professionals, that was true for the women and also for the men who reported none, they had blood pressure indistinguishable from the white population. That's really important because there's very few studies that have shown adjusting for other factors lead you to have the same level of blood pressure among the white and black population. So that's a non-trivial finding. How can we begin to interpret these results? Next slide, please. First, I think that the body may be telling us something that people may not be readily able to articulate, and this speaks to the importance of combining both quantitative epidemiologic types of research investigations with qualitative research. We can't assume that what people say out of our mouths is going to be the full story. Our bodies tell stories, too. And what issue may be what it means to say that you have never experienced discrimination if you belong to a population defined in part by such discrimination, as well as what it also means if you say that you've experienced a lot of discrimination. In some circumstances, a no may truly mean a no. In some cases, and there's some preliminary work suggesting this, a no is because it's too painful to speak out about such experiences. That was shown in one follow-up study of people who filled out a questionnaire and then did in-depth interviews afterwards. They felt like, what's the point of checking this box on the questionnaire? And a no may also refer to internalized depression. So that what does a no mean may be related to power and to resources, because it was interesting that the no had the most salience for an increased risk of blood pressure among the working class population in the study. And it's important to note that these kinds of findings have also been shown in research I've done in anti-gay discrimination and blood pressure, and it points to, and I'll be coming back to it, what some steps are for methodologic research on measuring discrimination if we're really going to move this research agenda along. Next slide, please. So for one thing, we need to move from the tautology that race explains racial differences in health or other outcomes to a substantive examination of how race relations drive population patterns of health, disease, and well-being. This is a point being made by many of the researchers that are active in the field, including one we'll be hearing from later this evening, Dr. Mindy Fullilove, who's also called for the importance of looking at what do the processes mean, not just what do the categories mean, but what do the processes mean. We also need to have methodologic research that's improved to improve measures of both race relations in terms of the level and time period of exposure. We need data at the individual level in terms of what people's self-reported experiences are of racial discrimination, whether it's directed at themselves, their families, their friends, or their group. We need data at the population level, and there are studies that are beginning to do this, looking at patterns of residential segregation, also political empowerment. We also need to be thinking very clearly about time period, in part through a biological life course, whether it's preconception, fetus, childhood, and adult, but also cohort effects. Does it make a difference if you've come of age before, during, or after the civil rights movement, for example? And I want to give you a preview in this next slide of a study that we just published, beginning to look at some new methods for measuring exposure to racial discrimination that may be applicable to health studies. Essentially, one of the questions that we have is, does it make sense to ask people questions explicitly about racial discrimination, given strong cognitive reasons that people may underreport what their experiences are, or not be happy, or dealing with shame and stigma? That there are ways that social psychologists have been working to deal with cognitive distortions, and so they've begun to measure implicit measures. Those implicit association tests were first developed actually to measure racial prejudice, because it was the finding that people were reporting not lots of racial prejudice, even when you think that there still may be prejudice in their society. Otherwise, I think we would be living in a rather different world. And so what happens with these ones that were developed for racial prejudice, we're looking at, for example, how people associated words like white and black with words that were positively or negatively valenced. For example, angel, heaven, cancer, hell, all kinds of other kinds of associations, and finding that if you look at people's reaction times, which is a computer test, and you're seeing how quickly you associate words, that you'd have people basically associate black with things that were awful and white with things that were good, and that these results would come out even when they were claimed they were not prejudiced. And they're a little more sophisticated than that. That's just the basic version. What a colleague of mine, Dr. Karen Ruggiero, who's actually now at University of Texas, has done with me working with her, is to actually begin to adapt this test to start to measure sense of being a target of discrimination. And that there's another hypothesis that's out there, which is that basically when you ask people about experiences of discrimination, you invariably find they're members of a group that's typically affected by discrimination. They report less discrimination for themselves than they do for their group as a whole. What are the reasons for that? Some of the reasons are that you can imagine that other people in your group have been in situations you haven't been and have experienced discrimination. But it goes a little deeper than that. It goes to, again, what it costs you to admit that you actually are being discriminated against. It's not a pleasant thing to admit, even though people on the conservatives may think that people love claiming being a victim. So what we had a specific hypothesis, which is that the personal group discrimination discrepancy gap would be greater if we use explicit versus implicit measures, and that our study results, which we've now published for gender and we will be publishing for race ethnicity, do in fact show precisely that. We measured women's experiences and men's experiences of gender discrimination using a 7-point explicit scale about how much they thought they as women and women as a group were discriminated against. And then we also asked the same questions using an implicit association test for women themselves personally and also for the group. If you look at the explicit measure, what you find is that women report for their group more discrimination than they do for themselves. But if you look at the implicit measures, where the measure there is the milliseconds of response time, you show virtually no difference. This is suggesting that there may be an implicit recognition of being targeted of discrimination even as you're not actually reporting that. And our strong sense is that this may be useful for future research beginning to look at the impacts of discrimination on health, and those are some of the steps we plan on taking. So next slide, please. I think that we face a lot of challenges in monitoring and analyzing racial inequalities in health. For one thing, at the population level, we need routine inclusion of appropriate racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic data in all U.S. public health databases. And this is a feasible goal. We also need, as has been discussed extensively today, more money for research on causes of and evaluation of efforts to address racial and other social inequalities in health, where we get to do things like explicitly study how racism affects health. And also in realms of civil, social, and economic rights in action, we clearly need to be linking public health agencies and researchers with civil rights, human rights, trade union, and environmental justice movements to counter the ways that institutional and interpersonal discrimination can harm health, including, but not restricted to, conditions of economic deprivation and exposure to hazardous conditions at work and in the neighborhood. So in conclusion, when we're talking about research and racial inequalities in health, we're talking about the biologic expressions of race relations. Biology does matter. How we get there is what also matters. Because what we're talking about is where and how the truths of the body and the body politic engage and enmesh. We need to document and analyze the health consequences of racial discrimination, and we also need simultaneously to document and analyze how people resist and can work to end racial discrimination and the harm that it causes. And I think a key message that's important not to pussyfoot around is that addressing racial discrimination is necessary for preventing disease, reducing racial ethnic inequalities in health, and promoting social equity in health. And we have to understand who benefits from racial discrimination and who is harmed, and what steps we need, particularly in the legal and policy arena, to end this insult to health. So in conclusion, I think it's fitting to quote the words of Audre Lorde in 1980, who said that our future survival is predicated upon our ability to relate with inequality. I think that puts forward the public health mission here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Krieger. Is Jerome Taylor still here? Okay.